It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, the increase in voucher schools around the country means that public money is often funding religious education that's not permitted in public schools.
First, today is World Tuberculosis Day. While TB may seem like a thing of the past, just last year an outbreak of multi-drug-resistant TB hit Sheboygan, Wisconsin. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a state health official about that outbreak.
First, around the world, multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis is increasingly common, and it's the subject of a new Frontline documentary called TB Silent Killer. In the documentary, filmmaker Jezza Newman travels to Swaziland, the most TB-infected country in the world. Let's listen to a clip.
Anyone can get TB. We all use public transport, and even at the workplace, you don't know whose health is in what condition. You don't know who's sick, who's not sick, who's faithful to their medication and who's not. So TB is just in the air. So whether you're poor or rich, you can't stop that. There's no way you can stop it.
That was Sina Kile, who had extremely drug-resistant tuberculosis. She's one of the stories told in the documentary TB Silent Killer. It airs tomorrow night at 9 on your local PBS station. We're joined now by filmmaker Jezza Newman. Jezza, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we're not that aware of it here, but how prevalent is tuberculosis around the world today?
It's huge. It's the second highest infectious disease in the world. So HIV AIDS is the first, and TB is the second. And in Swaziland, where we went, it has the highest rate per capita. So that means the most people against the number of the population. But the actual numbers in terms of people, you know, if you hit places like India, China, Eastern Europe, you get much higher numbers in terms of people.
And as you document in the movie or the documentary, one of the biggest problems is this multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. What is that? Why is it so much more menacing?
Yeah, I mean, basically, we've had TB around for a very long time, as we know, and it was all but eradicated from the West. Ordinary TB, there are drugs that you take which isn't too horrific and it's manageable, and the period of treatment's manageable. What's happened, though, is that in certain parts of the world, poverty levels are so high and survival is so difficult that people even defaulted on the ordinary TB, and the disease then mutated, and so now you have what you call drug-resistant or multi-drug-resistant strains of the disease. And the reason this is so bad is because the treatment then becomes really, really quite long. It's a two-year treatment for multi-drug-resistant, and the drugs are very old, and so they're highly toxic and have horrible side effects. So it's a whole new, it's a game changer, if you like. It's a whole new ball game. And what the patient goes through, almost the treatment is almost worse than the condition itself.
And you found people in some cases stopping the treatment because it was so painful, the side effects were so bad.
Yeah, I mean, for many adults who receive the treatment, you'll have loss of hearing to permanent deafness. The drugs often cause vomiting in patients, which is then another added complication because then your immune system was already compromised to have the full-blown TB in the first place. And now, not being able to keep your food down, you're obviously going to get weaker. Also, you get this kind of what I best describe as a kind of rheumatism, arthritis in your body. So your joints will ache and you're unable to sort of be highly active. So many people talk about after having had the injection that you have to have that, 3 or 4 hours you may be bedridden or at best, just able to sit around. But you have this lethargy that means that you really can't do the things you used to do. And bending down is painful. And so in the film, we feature a guy called Beggy who, he was a builder, he was a construction worker, and that was his living. And he wasn't able to do that anymore. And so, you start to get into this situation where it's not only the disease that's debilitating, it's not only the treatment that's giving you these side effects, but equally your life is imploding around you. You know, you can't do the things you used to do to survive, and you can't do the things you used to do, you know, for pleasure. And so you're not left with very much. So you start to see high levels of depression amongst patients as well. And if you think about it too, you know, if you're given a treatment for something, a course of antibiotics for a problem you've got, you know, it's a few days to possibly, you know, up to a week or so. Even if you had something where you had to take medication for 6 months, you can still kind of put a flag on 6 months, can't you? You could, if I said to you, oh, let's go for a drink in 6 months, you could kind of go, well, that's a long time away, but I can kind of comprehend that. Imagine saying we're going to do something in 2 years' time. That becomes, whoa, I can't really comprehend 2 years. And that's the treatment period for this disease.
Well, especially thinking about a child going through this situation. And that's one of the most powerful stories you tell in the frontline piece. Nakbega, am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah,
a young girl. At the beginning, she's already lost her mother to drug-resistant tuberculosis. Can you pick up her story from there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she'd actually lost her mother just 2 weeks before we met her. So it was already quite raw for her and her brother, Malusi, who she lived with. But, you know, without giving too much away on the film, you know, still want people to come watch it. But, you know, she is diagnosed with this multidrug-resistant form of the disease. And to protect her brother, has to head off to the TB hospital, which basically means she lives in isolation for a while. I mean, I think what's so amazing for me about the film, I mean, not as a film, I'm not, you know, but for me, the character and Nakbega is, and why one should really watch this film, I think, is just from how she deals with this. I mean, I think it's inspiring how this little girl, all on her own, gets through what she has to go through, still with a smile on her face and a twinkle in her eye, you know. And for anybody, I think that, you know, she, you know, the days I've been annoyed because I've been stuck in traffic, I have to just take a look back at Nakbega and think, my God, you know, that's nothing compared with what she's going through.
That suffering, the disease itself, the loss of her mother, the isolation from her friends and family, and the horrible side effects, daily injections. I, as a grown-up, I don't know how I would deal with that.
Yeah, and you figure also she's losing her education, you know, and her education is her future. So she's not getting school while she's in hospital, and that's always tragic, you know. For any child, you know, you would hope that they at least have a platform upon which they can change the world they're in. But we kind of hand it to them as adults, and they have to live it. But when you also see them losing that chance for change, when you see them that hope slipping away, I think that's hard. You know, that's heartbreaking too, I think. But, you know, for now, you know, Nakbega has this positivity around her, but, you know, it's still a major struggle. I mean, you talk about the treatment. The treatment is, you know, 6 to 8 months of injections and 2 years of pills. So little Nakbega at 12 years old, by the time she's finished her treatment, will have had up to 240 injections and swallowed 14,600 pills.
And while she stayed positive through a lot of that experience, as we heard in that clip from Sina Kile at the beginning, it seems like there's a sense of dread. Even for people not suffering tuberculosis, it just seems like they all feel its presence around them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I found that when I was on the ground there wasn't many a person I'd meet who didn't, at the very least, know someone suffering from TB, and I think that it's this whole social impact that is the real killer. You know, it's not like you're just having a disease that could potentially kill you. Let's remember that. It's also the fact that the treatment is debilitating and gets you. But equally, you also lose your life because, you know, your friends don't want to come near you because they're worried. It's an airborne disease. It travels through the air. So people are terrified that if you come near them, well, I might get it, you know. So you start to lose your friends. You start to lose your family because they don't want you near you. And, you know, how many people can actually afford a living, you know, living in accommodation where you can have a complete separate room and living space from your family? I mean, even in America, there aren't many people who are living in cities who can say that, oh, well, I can have this one apartment for them and an apartment for me. It doesn't happen. And you can't all live in the same apartment together, because then obviously you'll pass the disease from one person to the next.
And not to keep layering on even worse things, but we've been talking about the multiple drug-resistant strain of tuberculosis. You also talk about the extremely drug-resistant, even this horrible treatment we're talking about, another strain is resistant to that.
Yeah, I mean, sadly, that's what's occurred. And it's gone beyond that even. You know, it's gone to TDR, which is totally drug-resistant, which is literally a death sentence. But even with extremely drug-resistant or extensively drug-resistant, you know, the prognosis diminishes rapidly, and it's a tough one, you know, because then you start to witness, you know, to get organ failure, and the drugs are damaging to the liver and other organs of the body, and the disease itself, you know, whilst it's, you know, it attacks the lungs, it, you know, the whole body starts to shut down really, because it's so debilitating, and death ultimately, when it comes, is not pretty.
So you told this story, you documented this story of these people from our perspective over there, in this case in Swaziland. What do you hope we here watching in Wisconsin, in the United States, in the West, do about it? How are you hoping people will take what you show us and do?
You know, this is a neglected disease. It's considered a disease of the past in the West, and I don't think it is a disease of the past, and that's certainly not what the advocacy groups are saying, and that's not what the stats are saying, and it travels by air. I think that people can get it out there on a platform. You want it talked about politically, so you can write to senators, I believe, is the way you do it here. You know, write to your senator, say, hey, I want people to talk about this. You know, go and do a bit more research into the advocacy groups that work in this, Doctors Without Borders, and Results and other organizations, and maybe you could support them. And understand that right now what we need, unfortunately, sadly, you know, a lot of this comes down to money. You know, we need research and development in drugs, in one instance, and affordable drugs. Out there on the front line, they need more money to help have decentralized care, because right now, you know, if someone travels to hospital to get treated, they can be infecting people on the way. And there's that scene in the film where Nottbega has to travel on three buses to get to hospital. She could potentially be infecting people the whole way there. So what the Swazi government want to do is decentralize, which means teams go out to the patients rather than the patients coming to them. But that costs. You know, you need vehicles, you need fuel, you need nurses, you need doctors. And ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And right now, my understanding is that here in the health budget in America, they're actually cutting the TB program, the money to the TB program. So, you know, that needs to be reversed, because we're really good in the West at being reactionary. You know, when there's a flood, you know, the houses get flooded and we go, oh, we should have built bigger dams. You know, if there's a hurricane and it knocks all the houses down, you know, you kind of think, well, maybe we should have spent a bit more money and built those tower blocks better. But we wait for it to react. We don't preempt, you know, because for whatever reason, whether it's a political term, whether it's, you know, just the money that's available at that time. But the reality is if you have to fix this when it really is a problem, there's a serious problem, because you can't just develop these drugs overnight. You know, you can't. You're suddenly going to have hospitals where their capacity is cut to a third because the bed spacing you need for TB is 13 feet apart. So suddenly you won't be able to hold the same amounts of people you have. So, I mean, it's one of those things that right now, no, sure, it's not a massive, massive problem. It's not something that, you know, many people, you know, are hearing about on a daily basis. But the reality is it's creeping up on us. And if we're not careful, by the time we realize it's a problem, we've got a serious problem.
Jazza, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for your time.
We've been speaking with documentary filmmaker Jazza Newman. His documentary TB, Silent Killer, airs tomorrow night at 9 on local PBS stations.
Next, we talk with Lorna Will, a state health official who helped respond to the outbreak of tuberculosis in Sheboygan last year, as we mark World TB Day. Today is World TB Day, and we just spoke with filmmaker Jezza Newman about his new documentary, TB Silent Killer.
Now we're joined by Lorna Will, director of the Respiratory and International Health Unit at the Wisconsin Bureau of Communicable Diseases and Emergency Response. She was involved in the response to the outbreak of a multi-drug-resistant strain of tuberculosis in Sheboygan last year. Lorna, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
So how did this outbreak in Sheboygan get detected? How did we first find out about that?
Well, the lady who had the TB at the beginning was finally diagnosed after about 7 months of multiple visits. And at the time, we didn't know we had an outbreak. We knew we had a case, but then we found that virtually all of her family was infected, and many of those people also had disease. And she came from a very large and close-knit family. So two households were affected in Sheboygan County, and we ended up with 12 total cases of disease.
And how much of that was outside their family? How much did it spread into the community?
It was all in the family. Hmm. There were not cases outside the family.
And you said she had been seeking medical treatment for a long time, but tuberculosis wasn't on the radar, I guess?
I guess not. And there were several difficulties because we had some cultural differences in what people expected as far as most of our TB in Wisconsin is in people who are foreign born, and they have sometimes different expectations of what TB is like and what the symptoms are supposed to be. And sometimes some difficulty in getting that information across to their clinician. And so yes, she sought care several times and was seen several times and was finally diagnosed several months after her initial illness began. So that gave her lots of time, unfortunately, to pass the disease along.
When a clinician detects something like tuberculosis, then do they immediately report it to the state?
Absolutely. It's an immediately reportable disease, even if it's just suspect. We don't want anybody to have to worry about did they get the right culture or anything like that. If there's any suspect case, they should call the local health department immediately, and that it is an immediate reaction. The health department will work with the patient, investigate the family, find out if there are infants or small children in the family who are at high risk of getting disease. They'll coordinate all the testing. And in Wisconsin, we're able to do this all for the patients for free, regardless of, you know, if they are underinsured or uninsured, whatever, we can take care of that for them.
So you immediately start trying to trace people maybe they're in contact with on a regular basis, maybe even go to schools?
No, we don't do that right away because it tends to freak people out.
Ah, fair enough. Okay.
And most of the time, because we do have we had 50 cases last year, we have very few cases compared to many other places in the U.S. So most of the time our investigations show that it is not TB. So what our main concern is the immediate family, because infants and small children, I believe, as you've heard, are at very high risk of becoming infected and moving immediately to disease. And so that's our first priority, is to assess the patient, him or herself, and make sure that any other family members who could be quickly affected are taken care of. And we concentrate on just trying to figure out exactly what's going on, calming the situation down. There's frequently, reports or suspicions or rumors going around, and we try and keep everything calm because, as I said, most of the time people do not have TB when we investigate.
And the tests for TB, are they pretty solid, and we know after taking a test or two, or how solid are they, I guess?
It all depends on where your TB is. If you have TB in your lungs and you can cough up a good specimen, we can get it to the state lab, and within a day, we will have an ID. We will know is there DNA from TB in that specimen or not. However, if you have TB outside the lung and have to have a biopsy, or you can't cough up sputum, then it can be very difficult because the diagnostic tests we have, the blood tests, are only for infection, and they have a lot of false positives. And the tests that we have are not very good for TB, quite frankly. But the culture is still the gold standard, and the culture can take up to 8 weeks to grow. So as you guessed, that might be a very worrying period of time for 8 weeks to be waiting to find out yes or no.
Our last guest was making the case that maybe we're not ready enough for tuberculosis in the United States, in the West. Do you feel like at least the state of Wisconsin is ready to respond when future cases emerge?
I think in Wisconsin we are in very good shape because we have our legislature has been kind enough to give us funds both emergently, as they did in Sheboygan's case, but on an ongoing basis so that I can assess anybody who shows up in the state of Wisconsin with signs or symptoms. We can cover their assessment, we can cover their care, we can cover their medications. This is not true across the United States. It is complete patchwork. Where you, how you are treated, how you are assessed, and whether you have are expected to pay for your medications depends entirely on where you are. And in many cases, local county health departments are supposed to be, or the patients themselves, are supposed to be picking up all the costs for this.
Lorna, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Today is World Tuberculosis Day. We've been speaking with Lorna Will, Director of the Respiratory and International Health Unit at Wisconsin's Bureau of Communicable Diseases and Emergency Response.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a guest says we can make ourselves happier by harnessing the power of our personal data. Learn how to hack our happiness.
First, voucher schools are on the rise around the country. They began here in Wisconsin in the early 90s and have since taken off elsewhere and are currently being considered in many more states. The voucher system allows public funding to go to private schools.
While these schools may get taxpayer money, state and federal departments of education don't necessarily have a say over what's taught in the classrooms of these schools.
The result is that as the number of voucher schools increases, so does the amount of public money going to fund schools that teach concepts like creationism and intelligent design, things generally not taught in public schools.
Politico reported on this trend today. Senior education reporter Stephanie Simon is here with us now to tell us about it. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
So it sounds like, in the midst of a boom in voucher schools. How big is the growth? Why is it growing so fast?
Well, the number of students who are attending schools on some type of voucher, who are attending private schools on some type of voucher or tax credit scholarship, is up about 30% just in the past few years. It's at 250,000 nationwide. So that's still just a small fraction of the total number of public school students in the U.S. But more and more states are considering these vouchers and these tax credit scholarships, and they're sort of a popular way for politicians to offer more choice to parents and give them more of a say of where their tax dollars are going.
I know that it varies some from state to state, but in general, how does public funding for these schools work?
Well, there's a couple different approaches. So you can have a straight voucher approach where the parents can apply for a voucher from the state that helps them pay tuition at a private school, and that comes directly out of the state treasury. Or you can have what's called a tax credit program, which is where individuals and corporations are encouraged to donate to nonprofits that then provide scholarships for students who are eligible for the vouchers. And in return for those donations, they get a substantial tax break. In many cases, they get 100% of their donation back on their taxes. So if you're an individual with a $2,000 state liability, you donate $2,000 to the scholarship organization, you wipe out your tax liability, and you may even make money because you can also claim that donation on your federal taxes and get a credit for that.
When the state or the federal government provide funding, do they keep say over the curriculum at these schools?
No, almost no say. And you're having a debate right now in Wisconsin over what kind of accountability measures should be in place for schools that accept vouchers. But in most states, that students who accept these vouchers are not required to take the same tests as public school students, and the government doesn't retain a say over the curriculum. So the schools can teach what they want as long as they meet certain health and safety guidelines that the state sets.
So you found that in a lot of these schools, creationism or intelligent design are being taught, things that usually wouldn't be taught in public schools. How widespread is that?
Well, not only wouldn't they be taught, they're not supposed to be taught at all in public schools. That we've had decades of litigation on that question, and the courts have come down very firmly that public schools are not supposed to teach creationism or intelligent design because those are viewed as religious theories rather than academic theories. And so, but the private schools are free to do that, and there are hundreds of schools all over the country that receive public subsidies that do teach creationism. And what this story on Politico explains is that it's not just a matter of teaching during, you know, one unit in biology class that God created the earth in 6 days. It's a creationist philosophy that goes across the whole curriculum and that encourages students to really distrust and seek to rebut all kinds of mainstream scientific views and even mainstream mathematical concepts like set theory. And it's a view that extends, you know, from kindergarten through 12th grade across all subjects.
Objecting to math theories, why is that?
Well, there's a popular set of textbooks that doesn't include modern concepts like set theory because they hold that God established the laws of mathematics and we should stick with the ones that, in their view, are old and traditional and not fluid at all, and they don't like concepts like set theory that allow for sets of numbers to be self-contradictory and have different characteristics that, in their view, contradict the scriptural way of looking at numbers.
And supporters of vouchers being used this way say, I guess, hey, what's being taught in public schools is contrary to my values as a parent. Shouldn't it be my right to have the choice to send my kid to a school that teaches values we agree with?
Exactly. And they say, and they point out that, you know, they're paying taxes too to support public schools that are teaching things they disagree with. So turnabout is fair play, and people should be okay with funding their kids going to schools that teach values that they believe in. And as to the debate about how accountable they should be, whether kids should take the same kind of tests, supporters of vouchers generally say, you know, the school should be accountable to the parents, and presumably if they're giving kids a bad education or an inadequate education, parents will stop sending their children to those schools. So that's sort of the only check and balance that they want to see there.
Are we seeing pushback to the teaching of things like creationism and the other things you've mentioned in these schools?
Yes, it's a concern for people who are opposed to vouchers. So in a lot of states, for example, just in Florida, there was a huge battle just over the past few weeks over a plan to greatly extend and expand the voucher program there. They have a built-in escalator, so already without any changes in law, they're going to be vastly increasing the amount of money they spend on vouchers to send kids to private school, but proponents wanted to increase it even more. And creationism was one of the concerns that opponents raised, and they ended up winning and getting that further acceleration of the program killed just last week. So it is an issue that's coming up here and there in different states, and I think it'll be more prominent. Right now we have more than two dozen states right now considering expanding or enacting new voucher programs. And so this is going to be an issue that comes up in those debates as well, I'm sure.
That issue you mentioned was in Florida. That was legislative. Are there court challenges to taxpayer funding of these schools that teach creationism and other things that have already been rejected in the courts for public schools?
Well, on the federal level, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that it's perfectly legal for tax money to flow to the private schools that teach creationism or religious schools in general, so long as the vouchers first go to parents. So parents, the money isn't going direct into the private school. It goes to the parents who then have to turn over the check to the private school. So the Supreme Court has said that's okay from a federal constitutional level, but from a state constitutional level, certain states have provisions that are much stricter than the federal constitution on this matter. So right now there's litigation going on in New Hampshire and Colorado and Alabama. The New Hampshire one, actually, the court's going to be hearing arguments on that in a couple of weeks, and that's contesting precisely this question of whether tax money can go to religious schools.
What's been the reaction from the scientific community or the science education community to these findings that more schools are using public money for this?
Well, you know, they're appalled and they're very concerned that students aren't getting the grounding in basic facts about the age of the earth, the age of the universe, and the process by which, you know, humans came to be here, the long sweep of evolution over 4 billion years. And they're also concerned about the anti-science type views that are nurtured through these type of curriculums. And as I said earlier, it goes beyond just teaching this is the story of how we came to be here. They're really, if you look at the school websites, as I did, and if you look at their course syllabuses and textbooks and workbooks, threaded throughout it is just this sense that we can't trust the secular world, we can't trust modern discoveries. And that really disturbs science educators because they fear that, you know, the kids who learn this will carry that through in their life and be not only skeptical but hostile to mainstream science and mainstream views.
A lot of the impetus behind voucher schools and other alternatives to public schools has been, hey, we need competition because the public schools aren't always as high quality as we'd like them to be. The competition will boost that. Are parents seeking out these alternatives more for quality or more for some of the religious reasons you've been talking about?
Well, really, it's both. I mean, there were two fascinating studies in the past 6 months from the Friedman Foundation, which supports vouchers, and they asked parents receiving vouchers in Georgia and in Indiana what their reasons were for seeking out a private school and getting the state subsidies. And in both cases, better academics was virtually tied with religious education as the top reason for parents in Georgia, and better education was just a few percentage points over religious education in Indiana and way ahead of other topics, like other possible reasons like smaller classes, safer school, better discipline. Those were all largely secondary to the idea that they would have better academics and also a stronger religious education that reflected their values.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Stephanie Simon, senior education reporter for Politico. Her report on the public funding of religious education through the voucher system came out today.
In today's internet age, we tend to leave a digital trail of breadcrumbs wherever we go, whether we're tweeting about what we had for lunch, reading an article on a news website, or using an app to map out a morning run. We're amassing personal data that marketers and other groups can't wait to get their hands on.
And while that digital trail isn't going away anytime soon, our next guest says we can take back that data for ourselves and start putting it to work. And by doing so, we can use it to better understand ourselves, our lives, and increase our overall happiness.
Joining us now is John Havens. He's the founder of the Happathon Project and a contributing writer for Mashable and The Guardian. His new book is called Hacking Happiness, Why Your Personal Data Counts and How Tracking It Can Change the World. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
At the beginning of this book, you write about how you had a revelation about this idea of our digital entities, identities, and what they mean. Could you talk about what happened and how you first got started thinking about this?
Sure. My dad had passed away, and I found myself, like most people when you're sort of examining grief and thinking about loss, sort of saying, how can I take a measure of my life? And in my case, I wanted to take it literally and track my actions digitally. And when I started to do that, I realized that my data, how it's being used and managed by others, was a huge part of my identity. And that became a real purpose for starting the nonprofit that I did, the Happathon Project, and writing this book.
Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of just how much digital data we're generating right now and where all of it is coming from?
It's easiest just to say ubiquitous and all the time, in the sense that a lot of people think their digital data is mainly about their computer when they knowingly enter in data, say, to subscribe to a service. Then people also are aware of, say, their mobile phones, and they get the idea that their GPS data is also now with them when they walk around. But now with something called the Internet of Things, which basically just means sensors like RFID chips or surveillance cameras, essentially data is being tracked about us anywhere we go, whether or not you're on Facebook or even have a mobile phone.
And you write that we're kind of just at the very beginning of this huge technology boom that just sooner or later it's going to happen, that we're in line at a coffee shop and people will be wearing altered reality vision wear, kind of like Google Glass, and they'll be able to see our Facebook data floating above our head.
Yeah, I actually think, I'm a big geek, so I'll just say that. But I love studying this stuff, and I do think whether it's 5 years or 10 years, it's essentially, definitely going to happen that these tools will be something that people will want to use. I mean, for myself, and I don't know about the two of you, but I remember 10 years ago railing against the idea of using a cell phone. I remember telling my brother, I said, this is so rude. I would never use this. And 10 years later, it's almost fused to my body. So although people say like glass or even something called augmented reality contact lenses is something they wouldn't wear, when you think about a hands-free phone or a computer over your eyes, a lot of people will adopt it because they want to have their hands free to, drink their coffee while they walk along.
When you're thinking about all of this, you've used the word quantified self. Can you define that?
Sure. Quantified self is actually a term and an organization created by a guy named Gary Wolf of Wired magazine fame. And the basic logic is that you track your life using data to optimize your life. So you could actually use a pen and paper, or a friend of mine jokes about having a pair of fat pants, you know, the pants that you put on and you know you've gained some weight because they're really tight. Basically, it just means you're quantifying your life. You know that you want to lose some weight. So when you're able to track or take a measure of your life on an ongoing basis, you simply have data to know how to optimize your life.
So we can use this data to optimize our lives. On the other hand, right now, all of that data, it's not really coming to us. It's going to other parties. And I think as internet users, a lot of us are aware of it, but we just sort of feel helpless about it. I mean, the options right now, I mean, you can opt out, which doesn't seem very feasible in today's world. And so how do we even start to navigate those waters, start to use it to foster well-being when we have no control over it?
Well, there's a new nascent industry, what's called the personal cloud industry. And people are probably familiar with, like, uploading data to, say, their Amazon cloud, or they may even use something called Dropbox, which is where you can store large files in the cloud, you know, sort of not on your computer. That same logic, these personal cloud, or sometimes they're called personal data banks, this is now a real evolving industry around the world. It's actually grown faster in Europe and the States, where people's PII, or what's called their personally identifiable information, data, can actually be housed in this bank sort of a format. And what that means is now in the future, we're hoping, or I'm hoping in the book, this is what I talk about, that people can sort of store their most essential, what's called the golden copy of their data. And then with any transaction, whether it's online, mobile, as they walk along, they can automate how they want their data and identity to be shared with the world.
So you are the owner of that personal data?
Correct.
And you could use it maybe to broker a monetary transaction, or you could use it in the ways that you write about, ways that sort of enrich your life. Can you talk about what that would be like, to use this data that's out there to make your life better?
Sure. I mean, the quantified self movement right now, there's so many great apps and wearable technologies, things like Fitbits, where the data that we have, some people are, you know, using the term big data. A lot of people with health data call it their little data. This wonderfully intimate information we've never been able to see before, it's now revealed. Things like, what does the sine wave data from my voice look like when I'm angry versus sad? And if I can timestamp that throughout the day and throughout the week, I can start to get a visual picture of a sort of a mood diary. And you can start to see, who am I with? Where am I when these different moods happen? And you start to gain insights about the places you're going that maybe aren't the best place to go to optimize your well-being. And then in terms of the data lockers, first of all that wonderful intimate information about your identity, I'm not trying to tell people how to share it. I would just love them to have the opportunity to make that decision for themselves. And then it also enables things like new, actually, economic structures, where people with a sharing economy, I talk about it in the book, like at a Starbucks, if someone wants to take your picture at a Starbucks, they can say, hey, can I, you know, pay you X amount of money to take your picture, because your face will be tagged when it goes up on Facebook. This type of a data bank or personal data cloud will allow that type of transaction.
So is that something that you can do now here in America? Can you own your own personal data on the cloud?
Well, there's a number of great companies. I interviewed a guy named Shane Green, who's CEO of Personal.com. I'm also part of the Hapathon Project, is part of what's called Respect Network, which is a group of personal cloud providers around the world. So I would definitely advise listeners to check these out. Personal, for instance, also has a great thing. I think it's called Fillit, where you enter in that golden copy of your data once, and then as you go to any website, you don't have to re-enter in your sign-in information 7,000 times. It does it for you. So it sort of gets you in the habit of seeing, this golden copy of my data is so precious, I should be the person to decide how it's managed and used.
Because right now, what happens to that data when it goes out there? Where does it go?
It depends on, you know, who you're signing in with, and most places have these Byzantine, you know, 48-page-long privacy agreements. That's for a particular purpose. They want to get people, you know, focused on the sort of ennui about hating to, you know, go through all that. You just say, yes, take my data. What people don't realize is that data can be used multiple times and sold or given away to multiple parties. It's not like when you hand a dollar bill to someone to buy something. That data can be copied, you know, a million times. And in the States, right now we're at a time where data brokers, companies like Axiom, et cetera, have been sanctioned by the FTC because right now those data brokers don't have to give copies of the data collected about us to us, even if we ask. So I think there's a great opportunity to have transparency and innovation where companies don't have to not have that data. They just have to have a better relationship with their users to say, this is how we want to use that data. Do you feel comfortable with that usage?
Can you tell us about the Happathon Project? What is that?
Sure. It's a nonprofit foundation I started. Our tagline is Connecting Happiness to Action. And we have surveys, and we're using mobile tools like the ones right now that are gathering things about, say, your marketing preferences. We want to have, instead of all these great and glorious tools be used just to track, you know, your purchases, we want to help people increase a sense of purpose. And by doing that, the survey that we have right now, it's at happathon.com/survey, and it's free, by the way. In a protected data environment, people know exactly how we're using their data, which is for research purposes. People track their values for 2 weeks, meaning for every day for 2 weeks in a quantified self way. They look back on their day and they reflect, did I live to these values each day? Because a lot of research shows that if you don't live to your values, your happiness decreases. And after they do that, after 2 weeks, then we send them back information and insights showing where they may not be living to their values. So the logic there is, by that tracking, you're taking an action that can actually literally increase your happiness. So we're doing that, and also global workshops around the world.
John, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to John Havens, the author of Hacking Happiness, Why Your Personal Data Counts and How Tracking It Can Change the World.